My passion is the fight for freedom. My father fought for World War II defending our country. Today, we are no longer fighting with guns. Instead, we are fighting an ideological battle for control of our country by contributing to causes that support your constitutional rights. I am Patriot Mobile.
That was a shooting gallery up there.
I could hear the tremble in his voice.
She suffered a fairly severe beating. The video is pretty graphic.
Justice for us seems almost impossible.
It's not fun to watch somebody die, and they knew she was in mortal peril.
They have not asked the hard questions. Why was the Capitol intentionally unsecure that day?
The FBI had information about security concerns before January 6th.
They're out for blood, and they're getting it. They appear to be winning.
Were the actions of the Capitol Police out of line? Were there violations in use of force?
Now I describe it as an inside job.
I'm ready to do whatever God calls me.
There's an old Chinese saying my ancestors learned before the Communist Party took over our country. The family is the essential unit of human society, and that you must have honor and defend your family. But it's not always easy to do.
When the regime gives the order, you have to kill.
My heart was pounding. I felt my body bouncing and twisting on the floor. They put numbers on our shoulders, then separated us into rows of even and odd numbers. I was number 9. My brother, he's still in prison. And my sister, she was sent to a labor camp without a trial. But there's one piece of evidence they haven't been able to destroy yet. I left everything behind. If I can't expose what they did to us, then all of our suffering would be for nothing.
Welcome to Chosen Generation with your host, Pastor Greg Young.
But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should shew forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy.
And now, Chosen Generation, where no topic is off limits and everything is filtered through biblical glasses. And now, here's your host, Pastor Greg.
And welcome back to Chosen Generation Radio, where no topic is off limits and everything filtered through biblical glasses. Hour number two. And if you missed any parts of hour number one, I hope you'll check out our first hour today with Rafael Cruz, who joins me on a monthly basis. And we really talked about the encounter and what it means to live out this walk with Christ and how his light working in us. That's the hope for the world. That is what's going to change everything. And we've got to believe that we've actually been saved. We've got to believe it. It's what gives us the moral authority, and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, gives us the moral authority to fight this evil that we're fighting. And my next guest has been fighting evil, calling it out, identifying it and saying, here's the line in the sand, you'll go no further. And I want to welcome Dr. Michael Schwartz to the program. Dr. Michael, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you, Pastor. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I started talking to people about this Wuhan thing with Nan Su from the Epic Times, and we traced this thing all the way back into, well, about 2013, 2014 originally, and then you know, the nonsense they did in 2019 and the laboratories and the release and so on. But now we've all come to understand the Fauci connection. You've done a deep dive into that. Talk to me about what you've discovered about Anthony Fauci and his involvement with this whole Wuhan virus.
Well, you know, even though the book is called Fauci's Fiction, it's not specifically about Anthony Fauci. It's about COVID as a whole. We were a little background. We were the first company to test for COVID in New Jersey. So I acquired over 19,000 patients. We did 44,000 tests. And we have, I think we're the only company in the country that has horizontal data. What that means is a lot of times we would test police departments, assisted livings, nursing homes, and we would test the same patients every single week for almost 3 years. You acquire a lot of data doing that. So even though the book is called Fauci's Fiction, it's not about, he's only mentioned in it three times. But if you look at the data that we acquired during this time, it tells you everything you need to know about Anthony Fauci, going back to some of the press conferences he did. You know, you could talk about mask wearing. We get into the vaccines. There's a lot of data that they really left out. And leaving data out is the same as lying to the public. So it doesn't make Anthony Fauci in particular look very, very good, but the government as a whole, just they botched this entire process.
You know, I had Naomi Wolf on, and we talked with her about some of the things that she uncovered as they began to release, you know, that document dump, which, you know, everybody was excited about the document dump. But I mean, who is going to sit there and actually pour through, you know, 50, 60, 70,000 pages and all of the data that was included in that? Your company really was a precursor to that, because you guys had your own independent data that you more or less looked at that and said, yeah, we knew that. We knew that. Am I correct in that assumption?
100%. In fact, what we were saying to our patients and to other practitioners in our office, the government, the media would not catch up for at least a year. You could go back to, everybody talks now about, you know, the Biden, where he comes on TV and says, if you get the vaccine, you can't give it or get it. My office looked at each other that day and laughed, because we had, and by the way, we never used the word breakthrough cases in our office, because we knew you could catch COVID very easily if you had the vaccine. We only saw 120-day antibody response from this. And to be clear to your viewers, we did not recommend the vaccine because we thought there would be issues from it. We didn't recommend the vaccine because it didn't work. So everything that they were saying on TV was so far behind, at least 6 months, sometimes even 18 months out. And yes, we had very early data to tell us that the rate of infection was very high, but the rate of mortality was very low. We actually predicted it to come down to that of the flu in April of 2020, 1 month into testing. You know, you got to understand perspective. We were hearing doom and gloom stories from the folks at the hospital putting people in body bags. We were out there testing police departments, school districts, you know, every random person in the world. And we're seeing that 90% of our positive caseload was asymptomatic or mild. And if you define mild as not needing hospitalization, we only had 4 patients in total go to the hospital.
Now, talk to me about what kind of treatment did your firm use?
We used very simple treatment regimens the entire time. It was a double dose of vitamin D. It was 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams of vitamin C. It was zinc and electrolytes. A lot of folks want to talk to me about hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. We never treated with those, but we had very high success rates with just very basic treatment. But what folks don't understand is there's so much information about COVID. That's why I wrote the book. You know, we're 3 years into this global pandemic where everybody's scared and everybody's going to die. And no one even to this day understands language. You know, it, even today when I call a positive patient to tell them that they've got it, they'll ask me on the phone, they'll say, do I need to quarantine? And I say, no. What did the astronauts do when they came back from the moon? They quarantined in case they were exposed to something they didn't know. Language is very important. When you're positive, you isolate. And I know that sounds just like hyperbole, but at the end of the day, you think if we were in the most deadly situation ever known to man, we should all be on the exact same page as far as language is concerned. And that just doesn't include, you know, basic language, but the timelines of how viruses transmit, incubation periods, how long a virus stays in your system, how to properly test for the virus and how to properly treat.
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't know if you did any studies into this, but when I was looking at this initially, too, and I mentioned to you about, you know, talking with Nansu and so on, one of the things that popped up was the Hong Kong flu back in the 1960s. And you know, I had seen a meme. Somebody put something out about, you know, in the middle of the Hong Kong flu, we had Woodstock. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to look that up. I mean, you know, because you don't want to say something that's, you know, inaccurate. And I was like, well, I'll be darned. They did have Woodstock with the Hong Kong flu. So I knew my mom had worked for a pediatric office. She was the back end manager of a you know, pretty good sized pediatrician's office. So I called my mom up and I'm like, hey, mom. So you remember the Hong Kong flu? And she says, yeah. I said, well, you know, you guys were treating kids and, you know, and this and that. And I said, you know, what do you remember about it? She goes, you didn't get it. I said, oh, I said, well, did you guys wear, you know, did you wear masks? Did you? No. I was like, okay. I mean, doc, that was, you know, she was just kind of like, yeah, she's 84 years old. And she looks at all this and she's like, this is nuts. These people are crazy.
Well, it's kind of obvious that we exploited this. I don't think COVID would have been COVID if it didn't happen smack dab in the middle of a presidential election. I mean, that's kind of obvious to at least folks like you and I who pay attention. There's still a segment of the population out there, though, that's wearing masks. They're walking around scared of this thing, sanitizing their groceries. You know, my mother's one of them. My mother watches MSNBC all day. So a lot of times it depends on where you get your information from. The folks that were screaming follow the science the entire time were the folks that don't understand science as a whole. We don't wear masks for virons. And people will say to me, well, then why do you wear them in the hospital? We wear them in the hospital so we don't get over splatter on our face and we don't drool into the operative field. We do not wear those for viruses. If I were to take you to the Wuhan lab or the Winnipeg lab in Canada and say, hey, Greg, let's walk through the area where we test the viruses. And I said, put this cloth mask on. You'd think I was nuts. We just don't do these things. I cited Dr. Lydia Baruba in my book. She's from MIT. She did a study early on and just breathing in a room, 27.2 feet was the spread. But yet the government's making up numbers like 6 feet. We did a lot of pseudoscience during COVID and a lot of people bought into it. You know, bottom line, most people don't die from COVID, although COVID is very real. And there's a whole discussion about where it came from and how it got released. Mm.
Well, and I think that's interesting because, like I told you, we tried to go back to the origin of it, and based on information that we received from people that had been on the ground in Wuhan. I mean, you had 7.6 million cell phones that went dark. So, you know, when people say to me, well, you know, it's really not. Well, yeah, there is a danger. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, you can talk about, you know, pneumonia. And issues of that and seasonal pneumonia. Well, there is a seasonal pneumonia that hits every single year. I used to get it. And you know when I stopped getting it, Doc?
When's that?
When I stopped taking the flu shot.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot to get into here, Greg. I mean, we can talk about the shots. One of the things that you brought up about, you know, Wuhan, it's interesting. When we first started testing, you got to remember I have 19,000 patients, 44,000 tests. Again, horizontal data, very important. When we started testing, we noticed one thing. We noticed that natural immunity seemed to last for about 18 to 19 months. We did not have a repeat patient for that amount of time. However, once Omicron came out, you noticed that we were starting to have repeats roughly every couple months. Okay. So that natural immunity cycle that we thought would last 18 to 19 months every time you caught it
had
disappeared.
Okay.
What that tells you scientifically, if you think about it, and this is a little bit of science here for folks.
No, you're good. But
it shows you that the mutations at that point had there were so many different mutations of the spike protein that it was fooling the body. You could then trace this back to a point of single origin. If it were zoonotic, like they were trying to tell you, you would have had this thing spread a little bit differently around the world, and it would have had multiple mutations to start with. But when you have a single point of origin, you see that the novelty of this one I shouldn't say one variant, because a virus is not a living thing. A virus mutates the moment it enters your system looking for the best version of itself to survive.
Okay.
And as copies of copies of copies are made, most of them burn out. The ones that develop this crazy spike protein on the end are the ones that fool your body. But when you look at how often you can get COVID and how many variants are out there, you can trace this back to a single point of origin, which tells me that the lab leak theory made the most sense in the beginning, and I don't understand why they would try to different hypothesis.
Gee, you mean the idea that something must have been created by a creator?
Right.
Hello.
Close your mind, right?
Wow, that's how novel that must have been. You know, it's just such a novel idea. Relative to that, now they're talking about, I just had a friend of mine, Bill Federer, was at the airport a week ago Friday, and he was washing his hands in the restroom, and a TSA agent came in, and he's like, okay, so what's, you know, you guys are gearing up or what? And the guy was like, yeah, we're gearing up, and, you know, I mean, they're and of course, as you mentioned just a minute ago, you know, it's an election year, right? So the presidential election, we gotta shut everybody up and put them all in their homes and do mail-in ballots. And now we're gonna do that. You gotta shut everything down again. How do we address this now? Because they've already told us, oh yeah, well, there's going to be this big spike and all. How do we address this, Doc?
Well, there's a spike right now. The COVID hasn't gone away, but I can tell you how the government made the numbers go away. It's very simple. And this, I've been talking about this a lot on television lately, but people really don't understand. So before the CARES Act existed, you had to have a symptom. If you remember when you got a COVID test, no symptoms, no test, right?
Okay.
So you had to exhibit one of three things, either a cough, a fever, or shortness of breath. What we found, though, after when the CARES Act was instituted, you could get a test at any time you wanted. Any person, at any time, it didn't matter. You didn't have to have a symptom. When you start testing everyone on the planet, you realize, or at least in the country here, you realize everyone has this. But if you remember my data, out of all of my positive cases, only 10% of them exhibited a symptom. 90% of them were asymptomatic.
Right.
So when the CARES Act comes into play, the numbers go through the roof. Then they instituted rapid tests, and they distributed these to every household on the planet. When you do that, none of those get reported. You're not taking a rapid at home, calling the county and saying, hey, I have COVID, I need to isolate.
Right.
So those numbers artificially then go down. When the CARES Act expired and you could not get a test anymore, those numbers further go down. So what you're seeing right now in the reported numbers is a microcosm of what's out there. If you see a reinstitution of something like the CARES Act, get ready, Greg, because that is when they're going to start gearing up for the election. If you want the numbers to go up, let everybody test, because COVID is out there. We all know COVID is not as deadly as everyone said it was going to be in the beginning. So we all know not to worry too much anymore. And a lot of folks are saying, hey, I'm not going to get that booster anymore because they're tired of this nonsense. But if you want the numbers to go up to affect an election, all you've got to do is let everybody test at one time.
Do you think, I mean, there's been some talk that some of these tests, I've seen some of the videos where they've pulled tests out of the box and they've, you know, swiped the test and the swab comes back positive, having never touched anybody.
You're talking about rapid tests, though, correct?
Yes, correct.
All right, we do not use, you should not, period, use a rapid test to confirm COVID. That is an improper way to determine COVID.
Okay.
And I don't know how much time we have, but I can explain that to you.
You know what? If you've got time to go a little longer, I've got time today, we'll take it. I mean, this is critical information. People need to know what we're dealing with and how to respond to it. So I'm happy to have you stay.
Sure. When I have a patient come to my office and tell me they had COVID and I ask them how, they say rapid test, I literally laugh in their face. And I don't mean that maliciously, but we're 3 years into this again. We should all be speaking the same language.
Okay.
If you take a PCR test, the sensitivity of PCR test is done logarithmically. It's not linear. So in other words, it doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It goes 1, 10, 100,000, 10,000, 100,000, million, and so on, okay, all the way to level 36. So at level 1, you're looking for COVID on the size of something like my cell phone. At level 36, you're looking for something of the size of the solar system. Wow. At that solar system level, I only need 9 copies of the virus to tell me it's in your system and bound. So if you come back positive on a PCR test, you 100% of the time have COVID. However, if you come in between a level 27 and 36, the very high sensitivity, you have such a low viral load that you will never have a symptom. That is most of the patients. In contrast, a rapid antigen test, you need 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 9th power virus. What does that mean? Instead of those 9 copies of a virus, I need 9 million to 9 billion to turn that rapid cart blue.
Okay.
So if it turns blue, you definitely have something. That's the problem with rapid tests. You can turn positive for any coronavirus, including the common cold. So a positive on a rapid tells me zero scientifically, except the fact that you have something. But a negative on a rapid test tells me nothing, because you need so much virus to turn a rapid test. So you should never use a rapid test to diagnose COVID, period. And if you are going to somebody reputable like us, when you're sick, we do what's called a respiratory pathogen panel. My folks knew what COVID swabs were years before COVID happened, because if you came to us sick, we would swab you. That test would go off to the lab. And what we found, Greg, during COVID was the majority of the folks who were actually sick from COVID had a co-infection. Most of the time it was staph aureus, a respiratory staph infection.
Yeah.
But put it in context, I had a guy 2 years ago who had COVID, staph, H flu, and RSV all at the same time.
Wow.
If that guy went to Walgreens and thought he just had COVID, he would have thought COVID was the worst thing in the world. You have to properly diagnose what you're dealing with so you can treat it.
Well, I remember in December 2020, I got COVID, but I also had double pneumonia and I was coughing up blood. Now, as I mentioned to you when we were kind of in the green room, you know, with everything that happened to me, I sleep in a hospital bed. I mean, my room is a hospital room. That's just the way that's how was living my life, especially then, and even still to some degree now. So my doctor was like, "Well, I probably need to send you to the hospital." I was like, "Doc, under no circumstances will I go. The hospital's not going to do it. You want to prop me up in bed? I got a hospital bed. I know where the bathroom is. I know how to drink fluids. There's not." So I did what you suggested. I actually had Dr. Judy Mikovits on, and I went to 10,000 IUs of vitamin D. I started on quercetin with bromelain, and I power packed that. I did zinc. I did vitamin C. I did COQ10. And then he gave me dexamethasone, and he laughs to this day. He said, "I gave you the highest amount of dexamethasone I've ever given any human I've ever met." But he said, "I'll tell you, you're my miracle story," because I had patients that we lost. And about 3 months after this, roughly about March, when I went in and saw him, because was on video with me every day. He said, "All right, you can stay home, but we're talking every day." He's a great guy. And so in March, I went in to see him, and he says to me, "You know, if I'd sent you to the hospital, you would have died. They would have killed you. We would not be talking right now."
You're right. We did not know how to treat this early on. It was a novel virus. And I tell people, look, if you and I went to an indigenous island in the South Pacific and hugged all the indigenous people, a lot of them would succumb to stuff that we're immune to. So number one, it was novel. But number two, we didn't know how to treat things like elderberry flared this up. Blue protocol flared this up. Once we understood how to treat this and use things like proning, we treated this very, very efficiently. But it was the novelty of the virus, and of course the ventilators. The ventilator, we put people on meds way too early.
Dr. Brian Artis talked about, you know, he had a relative, and they put him, they gave him remdesivir, and that filled his lungs with fluid, and then they stuck him on a ventilator. And he's a doctor, and he's jumping up and down saying, trying to tell them, stop, you know, and the person, his relative passed away. And that was when he got, you know, deep into this fight of saying, listen, this needs to stop. He and Peter Bregan and, you know, and others. But, you know, you're talking about, you know, the testing. I have a friend, Michael Dougherty. I don't know if you know Michael. He has a lab, and they, you know, have been involved in running these tests as well. And it's we have to tell the truth. The public needs to know what's really going on. And I think what I hear you saying is it's okay to say, yes, this virus is serious and you shouldn't just blow it off, but it's also very treatable and survivable, but there needs to be proper protocols used and put in place.
Correct. And that's the point. I mean, this book, short book, 170 pages, this will teach you everything you need to know about COVID, the stuff that we should already know, but we're not paying attention to, the truth about testing and languages and everything we discussed today. This thing is very treatable. It is very survivable. We predicted that early on. I think the point of the book was that we knew this in April and May of 2020, two months into testing. And we tried to tell the public, but we were shadow banned by the media.
Sure.
I came out at one point and said, hey, we should adopt the Swedish model. And I got ridiculed because people said, oh, you're going to kill people. No, I was trying. You know, we take the virus very seriously, but you have to take life very seriously. We wanted people to live their lives.
Right.
The damage we did with the suicide rate, locking kids out of school, the businesses that were shut down, is reprehensible. And the fact that we knew this so early on and it couldn't get the information out, I finally had enough patients where I had this one-on-one conversation for an hour at a time.
Right.
That said, you need to write a book. And I did, because now when folks come in, I can say, just read the book instead of me giving a dissertation every time we talk. But we were the first ones to see it. We were the first ones to do it, and it's just a shame as we're screaming at everyone at the top of our lungs, trying to tell them what we were seeing on the ground, no one would let that information out. It is a real shame what we did to this country and the world.
Do you think that it was intentional that they quelled the information and shut everybody down? I get that initially maybe you got some people to buy into the fear part of this, but at some point, like you said, people knew. I know you're saying we were the first ones to come out there and talk about this, but you and I both know that others knew. I mean, it's coming out right now. The realities are, you can only mask a lie for so long. And the reality is, here we are 3 years later, and the bottom line is the evidence is pointing to the fact that they knew exactly what it was that they were doing. What's your hypothesis, if you have one, about why? What was their purpose? What do you think the purpose was?
I don't get into the conspiracy theories in my book simply because I wanted to just give people the facts and the science. But let them just make a decision for themselves. If you ask me personally, though, and I don't talk about it in the book, for us to look at each other in the office every day and say, why aren't they talking about this? Why every time we look at the news and go, why are they saying this now, 12 months later? You know, if you ask that question, you have to wonder, is there some kind of coincidence? And I guess in life, you know, there's really no coincidences in life. So if you find our staff asking each other for months and months and months, why aren't they talking about what we're seeing on the ground? You then start to wonder, is there a hidden agenda here? Like I said before, if COVID didn't happen during the election itself, I don't think COVID would have been COVID. You know, you're going back to what you just said about the story in Woodstock. We exploited this. We used people. They were pawns in this at the end of the day, in my opinion. And I think people deserve answers. Somebody has to be culpable for this. And why I wrote it about Anthony, why the book is called Fauci's Fiction, he was the face of COVID. And as you can see, it is a Pinocchio nose coming through the face here. So, you know, lies or omissions, same thing. When you're not telling the public things that matter, you're disrupting the entire world. And that is that's not a good thing, right?
Well, that doctor, is it Burbeck? The other, Deborah, I think her name is Deborah.
Deborah Birks.
Yeah, Deborah Birks. I mean, she comes out in her book and says, I lied. I mean, she's straight up, as I understand it, in her book, she just straight says, yeah, I lied. I wasn't telling the truth about what was, you know, about what was really going on with regards to this. Nobody's held her accountable. There's been no real culpability. And you mentioned, I mean, the suicide rates and the, you know, what it has done and what it continues. I mean, we're not done with the ramifications of what happened as a result of that shutdown. And now they're talking about doing it again.
I haven't read her book, but she's lost all credibility with me. So is Dr. Fauci. So have a lot of the doctors that shut their offices down, the pediatricians that shut their offices and then started recommending COVID vaccines to five-year-olds. I mean, why? I have a story in the book about a cardiologist that I know that said at dinner one day, he said, I used to recommend the vaccines, but I don't anymore. And I looked at him and I said, are you nuts? And he's like, kind of like, where's this going in front of people? I said, you're a cardiologist. If I send people, we're primary care. If I have a cardiology issue, I send them to a cardiologist. I said, in no way, shape, or form should you be recommending anything you don't treat, you don't test for, you don't understand this, but you were going off the CDC guidelines. Those CDC guidelines were developed by people like Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci. So those folks have lost a lot of credibility with myself, and I know a lot of the public, the CDC, the government as a whole. I always tell people if you're getting recommended something, someone's giving you information, you should always ask them based on what. I don't think enough of the public did that, but I think the government media led them down a road that caused all this chaos. And you're right, somebody needs to be held accountable for it. I don't know where we go with that story. I don't know if it's somebody like Rand Paul who holds hearings and we get to the bottom of it. I don't think you're ever going to get to the bottom of it. But the fact that these folks have credibility and somebody like Dr. Birx is even selling a book, to me, is silly.
Well, you know, I mean, look what they're doing to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., right? You know, who was all over this. I mean, he was calling this out, the Children's Health Defense Fund, and what they were doing. Dr. Brian Hooker, who's a friend of mine, and the research that they were doing, and clearly identifying this. And the Democrat, they didn't even want him to come and testify before Congress about what had been done.
Yeah, a lot of people are trying to suppress that information. Look, even my book's getting suppressed. Amazon alone, and Amazon is one of my distributors. They make money off the book. I've tried to spend money to promote it. They sent me three letters back, Pastor, saying I can't spend money due to current events, whatever that means. We've been in this situation for 3 years. I think it's time to get the truth out to the public. Somebody doesn't want the truth out there because it's going to make a few people look bad, including the ones that were touting the narrative the entire time. So I think it's time that we open up the floodgates, let the information out, let people have access to it. They can make their own decision.
When it comes to, so you brought up the vaccine, so let's jump into that for a minute. When it comes to the vaccine, and I know, you know, we you mentioned also, I don't know, my wife, we were at the grocery store just the other day. We picked up some fresh fruits and vegetables. I ate a few on the way home before we got to the house, and I had some throat burn. Okay. Now I don't know if there's something put on it. I don't know if it's just chemicals, you know, that are on there from when they harvest it. I don't know for certain. But relative to all of that, as we're moving forward now, what is your advice for people right now as we prepare? Because we're going into, well, we're in the heat right now, and I get that. But now's the time, right, when you've got to get your immune system ready, when you've got to start preparing your body for winter and whatever, flus, colds, that whole season. Am I right or am I wrong?
Well, look, I look at it like this. If you're in the pool of population that is susceptible to succumbing to, you know, the end of life in the next 5 years, a cold can bring you down, a flu can bring you down, COVID can bring you down. You know, the object in life, I guess, is to try to stay as healthy as possible, right? I know you had some setbacks in life and you're getting yourself on the mend, which is fantastic. But folks, you know, working out, eating right, trying to stay healthy, sleeping, taking vitamins, those are all things you should do normally to prevent yourself from catching something. I was at an event last night and I said to a person, we were having a discussion on this. I said, if you look around at all the people in this room, there's probably 150 people. I said, I can tell you right now, at least half of them are probably fighting off a virus they don't know about. Viruses don't exhibit symptoms all the time, which we learned by doing mass testing. I said to my immunologist about a year and a half ago, and I wrote about this in the book as well, I said, I wonder how many asymptomatic flus are walking around in the world every day, because we don't test everyone at flu season. As we prepare for the next cycle, don't let the media get you too riled up. If you're not feeling well, I think you need to go to a reputable doctor that's doing a respiratory pathogen panel so you can diagnose, like we talked about, appropriately and find out what you're treating. Forget the rapid tests, throw them out the window. If you're going to a doctor who's doing a rapid flu and a rapid strep, probably not the best doctor in the world. You need to find a reputable doctor who knows how to work with labs, who can isolate what you're treating. Go to somebody reputable. It is important to stay on top of your health, but it is also important to understand viruses and terminology as a whole so you're properly prepared to move forward. I mentioned in the book, Greg, I said the very last chapter, I said, you know, where do we go from here? And unfortunately, I don't think the public learned very much during this exercise. I think if we had another pandemic or something come our way, we'd probably handle this exactly the same. You're starting to see that now again with all the mask mandates and lockdowns. So we need to get educated. That's the most important thing you can do.
I think it's interesting, too, and you bring up something that I think a lot of people are unaware of. I learned this because of experience I had with my wife. My wife came down with cytomegalovirus, and so she had a fever of about 102 to 104 for almost 14 months. And at one point, it was probably over 110, honestly, because she came down to 104 and thought she was normal. It was really, really bad. But what we discovered is that she was working in a preschool. And what we discovered is that kids carry these viruses and they're dormant in children and they pass them around. But if an adult gets exposed, that changes things. You mentioned that a lot of this stuff is lying dormant in people. So when you do the deep dive test, yes, you come back with a positive result, but it doesn't mean that you're going to have a symptom.
Well, so just to clarify a little bit, dormant wouldn't be the correct term. It's not lying dormant. It's someone gets infected. You're infected. Once you have the virus and it binds to your system, it starts replicating. The point is, if you're relatively healthy, it doesn't replicate as much to the point where it's destroying the mitochondria of your cells and exhibiting classical symptoms. So most folks that have a virus don't necessarily get a symptom. The most common symptom of COVID, and I ask people this all the time, I'll tell people, hey, you probably had it if you're, you know, somebody in your household had it, because 100% of the time, that in our data, everyone in the household had it. But they'll start and argue with me and they'll say, but I never had a symptom. And I'll say to them, what do you think the most common symptom of COVID is? And they always say, you know, cough, fever, shortness of breath. The most common symptom of COVID is a headache. It has to do with hemoglobin uptake issues. There's white paper out of Germany that we studied very early on to tell us that. And then, of course, fatigue. So once a virus starts to replicate, and then you can start, it'll start settling in different areas where you could exhibit classical symptoms. But most people don't have a classical. We probably would have never known this, Pastor, unless we did the amount of mass testing that we did during COVID, because, you know, traditionally you would never go to the doctor unless you're sick. You exhibit a symptom, go to the doctor, we determine what it is, and then we treat it. We learned during COVID that everybody had it. But again, 90% of my positive patients were asymptomatic or mild. 4 out of 4,000 positives went to the hospital. That's like 0.0001%.
Right.
And we lost zero patients. The folks that went to the hospital were vented too early, started bucking the vent. Those are the folks that succumbed early. And it was people that had diminished immune systems, had a comorbidity, had a co-infection. We learned that, though, very early on. And to not drag people through the mud for 3 years would have been a lot better than doing what we did and exploiting the situation. What's that book, Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals? Never let a crisis go to waste.
Absolutely. So, yep,
they absolutely. Took that advice.
if someone has, it's interesting you're mentioning that, because I'll get like a sinus infection, and this is the side of my face that was damaged. So there's no tube here running fluid that normally would wash out the sinus. So I get backup up in here, and I oftentimes will end up with, you know, the big green, loogies, whatever, that come out of my nose, which lets me know that, I've got some kind of an infection. Now, I like to use the colloidal silver as a spray to get up in there, and it tends to help. But would you suggest that the possibility then is that I might be fighting a low-level form of that infection? Is that possible?
So that green snot, and you got to remember, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a research doctor. I manage medical staff. But usually when you have color, it can be indicative of either bacterial or viral. So you don't really know unless you do a respiratory pathogen panel. We can see what you're fighting off. But, you know, if you keep developing something, obviously you have a little bit more of an issue. First step is, though, identifying what it is so you know how to treat it. One of the biggest issues we have, and the reason we did respiratory pathogen panels for years before COVID existed, was because there are 41 million antibiotics written every year, and 23 million of those are unnecessary. We overprescribe antibiotics, which causes antibiotic resistance.
Right.
So when you go to the doctor and they assume it's a bacterial infection, they'll write you a script. Or in this instant gratification world of Google, a lot of patients expect their doctor to write a script, and that's inappropriate. So we always will do the swab off to the lab and then appropriately prescribe. That doesn't mean that a practitioner can't make his or her own determination to say, I want to treat the symptoms, and then call you a day later and say, Pastor, it's viral. Let's pull you off the antibiotic. We want those antibiotics to be able to work for you in the long run for when you actually need them.
Right.
So if you keep developing that, I would just make sure, again, and I know you have good people, get a reputable test so you know what you're dealing with, and don't get that antibiotic resistance for your future.
Right, right. Yeah, my doctor tends to be, he'll prescribe an antibiotic, but he's like, no, let's use some other methods to try to deal with this, whether it's rinses or whatever, and kind of save the big guns for later, so that way they're most effective. And he actually, when I had it, he gave me, as I mentioned, the dexamethasone, but he also gave me amoxicillin. I think it was it was the 5-day. What's the 5-day one? Azithromycin. I think that's what it was. I think it was azithromycin that we did. And actually, because I had double pneumonia, he did azithromycin, and then he followed that up with a second round because of the fact that I was still coughing up blood.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like he's proactive. And by the way, I do love those sprays too. I use the NeelMed. I don't know Dr. NeelMed.
Oh yeah, As a matter of fact, when I after the accident, and I had gone in because they were going to do reconstructive surgery, but they found a tumor in my maxilloma sinus, which was a good thing that they found it, and so they went in and they took that out. And they had me get one of those NeoMed, the washes. And so, I did that, for months. But I still have it, and I use it. And it does help to ease the discomfort if there's something going on.
I use mine every morning. But you just brought up a really great point that we didn't touch on today. When they found that tumor, that's what's called an incidental finding. When we start talking about the vaccines now, that's how we're starting to find a lot of the issues. It's not a day later or 2 days later, an adverse reaction to the vaccine. Everything we're finding now, just like in your circumstance, is on an incidental finding. You go to the doctor for something unrelated. All of a sudden, we're finding a heart issue. We're looking at an EKG that looks like they had an MI. We're going, pulling an EKG from a year before that, and it's totally fine. And now we're doing an echo, finding they have an enlarged heart, something you would have never found because it doesn't exhibit a symptom that you would feel right away.
Okay.
And that's how we're starting to correlate the data on all the vaccine issues. And it's staggering how many are coming back.
Can we talk about that for a minute?
Sure.
So you mentioned that, people are coming in presenting one thing, and then that's leading to a finding of another issue, basically. So
yeah, Or, you know, in certain patients, and what we see from the vaccines, and by the way, we don't see anything from the J&J. The J&J, the Johnson & Johnson shot, was a viral vector vaccine. That is old technology. It's been proven to work. Although we get clotting from all three, the three that I dealt with were J&J, Moderna, and Pfizer. Okay. We get clotting from all three. But on the mRNA side, the Moderna and Pfizer, we're seeing an abundance of different issues, usually joint or heart. The joint issues can exhibit symptoms. So folks will feel that and they'll come in and they'll say, hey, I got something going on. But the heart issues, you don't recognize those. So it could be something as simple as going into the doctor without a symptom for maybe a surgical clearance for something else, a knee surgery, and then getting an EKG, and the EKG is coming back so bad that they can't clear the person for surgery. And they go into these and do more tests and find out, hey, you've got an enlarged right atrium or, you know, pericarditis, myocarditis. Right. And then all of a sudden the floodgates start to open. Well, how did this develop? And they'll pull further. I had a patient who had a CT scan recently of her abdomen, and they found plaque in her aorta. She's also having some issues with an enlarged heart now due to the shots. Okay. She had an EKG before the shots, totally fine. 6 months after the shots, enlarged heart. The same thing with the CT scan, incidental finding. It came up. They saw plaque in the aorta, which they weren't looking for. And he pulled a CT scan from a couple of years earlier and found it wasn't there. So you can see direct cause and correlation. The only thing we've been doing differently as a country is mass vaccinating everybody. Plus all the cancers that are coming back right now, you high instances of lymphoma. Right. Especially in young people. And it's kind of where, you know, it starts as a conversation amongst nurses and doctors and hey, we're seeing this. Are you seeing that in different areas? And all of a sudden you start to look at the data and go, wow, this is an abundance of new things that we're seeing that weren't here before the vaccines existed.
In your opinion, as a researcher, would you look then at these kinds of heightened increases results and say we have a public health crisis? We have a public health problem?
Not necessarily. You know, that's not my position. My position, I mean, we own three clinics, so we care about our patient load. We just sure. stumbled upon, because we were the first ones doing this. Would I declare a public health crisis? I mean, if you and I were running the NIH or something like that, maybe. If I was at that level, I would definitely get the information out there to say, hey, we're doing something different that is causing all these things, and we need to take a hard look at it. But you know as well as I do that data – when you're doing research can take, you know, years.
Yeah.
When you do a sample size and you start looking at patients, the correlation is there. It's not hard to draw trends. It right. wasn't hard for us to look at COVID and say, wow, I'm testing a household of five, one person's sick, the other four aren't. They didn't develop symptoms. They all got over it. You can see that when you do that over and over and over and over.
Right.
So what's the old saying, you know, that insanity, keep doing the same thing over and expecting a different result.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what we seem to be. I mean, that, unfortunately, that's it. I'll let you go here in just a minute, but that, you know, you made the comment, we didn't really learn enough, maybe because we didn't get enough information out, but nonetheless, we didn't learn enough, and it would appear that we are set to repeat the same mistakes all over again.
Well, we got to study history, Pastor, so that's why I did this. I implore folks. You know, obviously, you know, going out on a lot of TV, yep. radio, doing a lot of podcasts, pushing the book. But I have folks that call me up to tell me that this changed their life because they had no idea what we were dealing with. I had a liberal friend call me the other day, and I was nervous to hear his commentary, but he told me this book was the best book he ever read. And I said, I'm just sorry you didn't read it sooner, because he would have taken that mask off a lot earlier.
The book is called Fauci Fiction. Fauci Fiction. If you're watching us right now, you can see it underneath Dr. Michael Schwartz's name, author, Fauci Fiction. And I really, I'm looking forward to getting a copy of it, because I would really like to be able to, you know, look into it and start quoting some of the things that are in it to my audience, because these truths, these facts, you know, everybody's like, oh, yeah. And it's funny to me. It's like somebody all of a sudden found a nugget, you know, and you're like going, guys, seriously, I mean, we've known this. You're not, you're acting like you just invented the wheel. And, right. You know, I mean, we've had a wheel for a while, but nobody wanted to pay attention.
Yeah, now you know exactly how I felt for the last 3 years. Yes, Fauci's fiction. And again, it's a lot of folks make the determination when they see the cover. They think it's going to be political. It's not. They think it's going to be about Fauci and bashing him. It's not. It is simply the story of COVID from what we saw on the ground. And if you want to correlate that data and apply it to him at the end, that is up to the reader, but it doesn't make him or Burks or any of our officials that perpetuated this nonsense look very good. We need to take charge of our own healthcare, of our own our own destiny, and that starts with knowledge and understanding, and then we can start moving forward somewhere.
Wonderful, wonderful. Dr. Michael, thank you so much for being with me today. I greatly appreciate it. Fauci Fiction. Fauci Fiction is the book you're looking for, Dr. Michael Schwartz. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back. I'll close things out with you. And then remember to stay tuned 30 minutes after we go off air. But on our social media, we will be live in India with our largest outreach yet. We're expecting 2,000 people at this outreach. And I hope that you'll be praying for us, but I hope you'll invite people to watch it as well. I've got people that are getting ready to watch it in Africa. I've got people getting ready to watch it in Europe. I've got people getting ready, of course, to watch it in India as well. So encourage you to tune in. Dr. Michael, thanks so much for being with me. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to take a quick break here. Let me get that set and punched up, and we'll be back right after this brief break.